The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Monday, May 8th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And testifying before the Senate Intel Committee was former acting attorney general Sally Yates. A lot of qualifiers to that title. Not exactly a clean title. It ain't no chief content officer of the attorney general office. You know what I'm saying? Well, here is Senator Dianne Feinstein questioning former acting attorney general Sally Yates.
Lieutenant General Flynn remained National Security Advisor for 18 days after you raised the Justice Department's concern. Mm-hmm. In your view, during those 18 days, did the risk that Flynn had been or could be compromised diminish at all?
You know, I don't know that I'm in a position to really have an answer for that. I know that we were really concerned about the compromise here, and that was the reason why we were encouraging them to act.
You know, it is a sad commentary on the current state of politics that the only form of compromise we have is at the hands of the Russians. Is the sort of thing I'd intone if I were positioning myself as America's most trusted newsman, leveling with his audience as we fade to commercial. Scratch chin, so wise. And that's your world today. But I am not that guy. I am the guy who will tell you it is crazy cuckoo bananas that General Mike Flynn was the National Security Advisor and that he was compromised. Huge, screaming headline in neon that has fallen off the side of a building and is crashing towards your skull. That is the amount of attention you should pay to that. Another interesting issue, perhaps for whoever writes the full oral history of the huge neon sign that is crashing towards your skull, are questions like, who leaked the fact that the huge neon sign was crashing towards your skull? And why did the Obama administration authorize the neon sign to have full clearances, you know, before firing it? Let me put it this way. White House is warned that Flynn might be compromised by the Russians. That is the major thing to know. The sideshow is, hey, what about the leaking? Let's say I was introducing my kids to the Beatles and vice versa. All right. So I would say, here's the kind of headline things I'd say. I'd say they were the greatest band in history. They had 20 number one hits. And then I play Yellow Submarine and Twist and Shout, or maybe Let It Be. And then far, far down the list, I might say something like, you know, George Harrison is credited as L'Angelo Misterioso on the song Badge by Cream. Right. That is where the leaks come from. Big headlines. Beatles are good. Flynn compromised by the Russians. Well, anyway, let's check in on how regular Americans are handling this screaming neon revelation. Here's a regular American yesterday on Face the Nation.
Do any of you have a story that you hear about all the time that you think this story is not important and I don't want to hear any more about it?
We'll go with Russia, okay, because that was one of the things that's driving me absolutely mad. I think Russia has already been proven to not have had any impact on our elections. They did not, you know, drive from polling place to polling place and, you know, hoodwink the machines and whatever.
Ah, democracy. It is the worst system, except for all the others. Is what I'd say if I wanted middle Americans to like me and pump up my Q rating. In point of fact, these hearings were stark, unambiguous, and horrifying. Democracy is the best system, except when it's undermined by a quasi-dictatorship working in plain sight, much to the indifference of 40% of the electorate, Barbara inclusive. On the show today, I will revisit the panel that John Dickerson was putting those questions to. But first, when you think about the genesis of Trumpism, pick a locale. Moscow? Nah. They were opportunistic. They saw the opportunity. They didn't form the whole Trump thing. All right, maybe Queens, where the scion of an outer borough developer first developed a complex, literally and figuratively. But maybe, just maybe, you want to look at Durham, North Carolina, where a couple key figures on the modern right figured out just how the game was played.
I'm Jane Perlez.
longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
As a high school student in Santa Monica, Stephen Miller, future senior advisor to Donald Trump, clashed with administration and fellow students. He decried multiculturalism, bilingualism, and liberalism. No ordinary, iconoclastic young conservative eager to brand himself an outcast in a liberal enclave. He actually became something of a national figure, going on national conservative radio like the Larry Elder Show to grouse.
Am I the only one who is sick and tired of being told to pick up my trash? And we have plenty of janitors who are paid to do it for us.
When it came time for college, Miller went to Duke. And there he was handed a horrible kind of gift, the Duke lacrosse case, in which a team of privileged white players were accused of raping an African-American stripper. The players were eventually exonerated. The state actually took the unprecedented step of declaring them innocent, and prosecutor Mike Nifong was disbarred. There, opining the whole time, was Stephen Miller. Everything he ever said about liberal media and liberal colleges was being vindicated before his eyes, and increasingly before the eyes of the nation, as the college undergrad got booked on CNN, CNN Headline News, and here on the O'Reilly Factor on Fox.
On the one hand, they realize there's absolutely no foundation for anything they did, but on the other hand, they're not going to confront the flaws of their own radical and divisive ideology.
But what kind of message is this?
But it wasn't just Miller whose persona was forged by the Duke lacrosse case. Also on campus was a grad student named Richard Spencer. The case made him too, and he went on to rebrand American neo-Nazism as the alt-right. Reeves Weidman wrote about the Duke as crucible case for New York. He's here now. Hello. Hello, Reeves.
Thanks for having me.
So who was Miller on campus before this scandal hit? Just an annoying dude with a column?
Well, probably depended on your own political
views. Well, if you
views.
Went to Duke.
If you went to Duke, yeah, that's true. But he was kind of this sort of conservative gadfly. People knew who he was. He was the most vocal conservative voice on campus, sort of opining on the typical issues that you would expect a 19-year-old campus conservative. You know, the war on Christmas, Hollywood is terrible. But it wasn't really until the lacrosse case that he sort of became kind of a much bigger figure.
Because then the stakes were higher. It wasn't just him opining about, like, you know, kind of reheated Fox News tropes. This was something really happening that he had near firsthand knowledge of.
Yeah, and he became sort of the go-to expert early on. He was on CNN. He was on Fox. He was on Nancy Grace at one point, like five nights in a week.
Yeah,
and it's easy to kind of find a liberal student on an elite campus. It's harder to find a conservative student that's willing to speak out. And at the time, particularly early on in this case, people were not speaking out in defense of these players. So it was an extremely unpopular position for him to take.
You, I assume, read all the columns you could get your hands on,
yeah,
and saw all the opinions.
I did.
Did he immediately weigh in, or did he wait at all for some facts to come out?
He wrote sort of a strange column right away. I believe it was called either Welcome to the Durham Petting Zoo or something relating to the Durham Petting Zoo, which Durham is the city that Duke sits in. It has a large African-American population. At that point, early in the case, one of the sort of bigger themes was like Duke students hadn't done a good job of engaging with the community, that in fact it was sort of separated off, that in some way they looked down on the people of Durham. Miller wrote a column where he said, I look down on the city of Durham. And early on,
was he just reacting to the rush to judgment? Because you didn't even have to have all the facts in before you know, I covered the case from a media perspective, and I had no idea what the truth was. But it did strike me that the media was creating these grand narratives of town versus gown and white versus black without even knowing what possibly happened in that lacrosse house.
Yeah, his reaction early on was like, we don't know. Yeah. We don't know the facts. And, you know, the convenient thing for him was it did fit his narrative. He had talked before about the faculty was just all leftists. And so he would sort of make this argument that, you know, oh, the players' due process rights are being trampled. But then he would pivot immediately to just sort of lambasting the university, lambasting the media, and everyone who was rushing to judgment.
But to be fair to him, you know, Nancy Grace, maybe my listeners don't realize it because they know her as pretty much a conservative rush to judgment type. She did rush to judgment.
Yeah.
She was essentially saying, why do the lacrosse players need a lawyer? If I didn't do anything, I need a lawyer. And of course they needed a lawyer. Without a lawyer, they might still be in jail. When you watched his appearances on Nancy Grace, was he essentially making good points, do you think?
He was. I mean, he was making the point that we just don't know.
Yeah.
And he, in a lot of ways, was the good guy in this case. I mean, he was vindicated.
Well, he was right. He was on the side of the right.
And the thing that worked well for him was he had the facts on his side, which the facts in this case were that we don't know the facts. He stayed within what was known rather than rushing to judgment, which is maybe something that has shifted over time. But ultimately, because he sort of stayed within that, then you'd have Nancy Grace just sort of beating on him, and he would just kind of, he would stand there and he would take the beating and kind of stand up for himself and just say, you know, we don't know.
Yeah. Let's talk about Richard Spencer. Yeah. He was a grad student at Duke at the time.
Yeah, he was going for his PhD in the history department in, I think, European intellectual history.
But he wasn't being quoted. He wasn't being invited on Nancy Grace. He wasn't a big spokesman.
No, not at all. He was not speaking out. And the first time that he really spoke out, it was in January. The case sort of broke in March of 2006. And then January 2007, he gave this speech for this sort of paleoconservative club in Virginia that he had kind of gotten involved in. And that was the first time that he really spoke out. Around that time, as the case sort of unfurled, he did get involved in this Duke conservative student group that Miller was the head of. Richard Spencer became sort of a graduate advisor. What relationship they had is sort of in dispute.
Well, that's big. Miller always distances himself and specifically says, I didn't know him or I barely knew him.
Yeah.
Whereas Spencer says what? What did Spencer tell
Spencer,
you about the
relationship? Well, we didn't talk too much about that. Spencer has previously said that he was sort of a mentor to Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller said, that's not true. And Spencer, you know, sort of walked it back a little bit and was kind of like, well, we talked.
And again, to be fair, mentor-mentee, the more outspoken one was the undergrad, was Miller.
Yes, totally. Yeah. And Spencer admitted that, you know, in this case, he learned from Miller, you know, not, as he sort of told me, he at least claims he was sort of intellectually formed at the time, but in terms of the way to work the media, how to sort of stand in the face of arguments and criticism, Spencer, from the Duke lacrosse case, sort of says that he learned how to do that.
Did he say to you, did he tell you that his opinions changed? Were his opinions always that the white lacrosse players were getting railroaded? Was he radicalized just in terms of tactics or in terms of what he actually thought about races?
He says it was more tactics. Everyone who kind of knew Spencer when he was at Duke and in the immediate years after, he went and worked for this magazine, The American Conservative, that's not a far-right magazine.
Right.
And everyone who sort of worked there or knew him at Duke kind of says, you know, he would sort of inch towards things where you were kind of, you know, wondering where he was heading, but it certainly wasn't anything like what we hear today. And he says, before that, I was on an academic path. After that, I was kind of like, okay, this is a fight that I need and want to fight sort of more publicly.
What do you see in how Miller argues now? And he was trotted out that one weekend on all the Sunday shows.
And he hasn't been back so far.
It was sort of disastrous. He said maybe the Trump White House thought it was good, but, you know, he yelled, the president will not be questioned. Is that the sort of tactic he would take before he was actually a senior White House advisor? We'd see that interview from him, you know, a year before when it was Michelle Bachmann's advisor.
You know, it was similar in terms of his kind of like, you know, steadfastness, I guess, and always, you know, watching him again talk to George Stephanopoulos, he just kept coming back to the same sort of talking points. He would do that in the Duke case, but his talking points was, I'm stepping back to this place of we don't know the facts, him stepping back to this safe place. In the appearances he was making on TV, at that point, he was defending Trump's claims of voter fraud in New Hampshire. And Stephanopoulos kept asking, you know, well, what are the facts?
George, it is a fact, and you will not deny it, that there are massive numbers of non-citizens in this country who are registered to vote. That is a scandal. We should stop the presses. And as a country, we should be aghast about the fact that you have people who have no right to vote in this country, registered to vote, canceling out the franchise of lawful citizens of this country. That's the story we should be talking about. And I'm prepared to go on any show, anywhere, anytime, and repeat it and say the president of the United States is correct 100%.
He was trying to do the same thing of just, well, I'm just going to keep making the same argument, yeah, but it doesn't work if you don't have the facts to back it up.
So maybe we could say what he learned was certainty. The evincing certainty plays well, only it doesn't play that well when you don't have the facts on your side.
I hope so. I think, you know, Spencer certainly said to me that one thing he learned is if you just kind of stick with it and keep pushing back, people either get worn down or you break through. I mean, you know, it's sort of the lesson of the whole Trump campaign. Push through criticism. And even if you don't have the facts, if you just kind of push through and speak to your people, then maybe it works.
See, I think Spencer and Miller are aiming for different constituencies now.
True.
And Spencer knows that he'll never get most people on his side.
Right.
And I don't know if Miller thinks most is important, but there are enough built-in people who will support Trump or support a robust defense of Trump that he really is trying to convince a different kind of crowd than Spencer is.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think one thing I noticed and someone also mentioned to me about Miller's appearance when he's speaking on behalf of the White House is he was a little less combative. He was a little more, I represent the White House now. I'm not just, you know, this Duke student. So
right,
to some degree, he's pulled it together.
And at times he'd say he deferred. You'd have to ask them.
Right.
Which was a constant trope. Do you think that if the lacrosse players wound up being guilty, or if Stephen Miller wound up being wrong, he wouldn't exist today on the national stage? Like he needed the circumstance of having the facts on his side, which forged him, and from there he was propelled to stardom.
I wouldn't go quite that far. I think, you know, he has sort of had his conservative credentials. He had brought speakers to campus to criticize the faculty even prior to the lacrosse scandal. And, you know, his trajectory, I mean, no one could have predicted that he would be at this point. But I do think it did give him a bit of a boost and certainly formulated his sort of way of thinking. I mean, he has referred to it as sort of one of the proudest moments of his career. He would constantly show his appearances to, you know, other sort of congressional staffers as just sort of telling them about it. It was kind of cited.
That's what made him so popular.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
no, I mean, right, he was like legendarily the least liked guy on Capitol Hill.
Right. And I think, I mean, I also talked to Duke graduates who are, you know, horrified by whatever small role they had played. I talked to one guy who even went so far as to try to get Miller banned from his upcoming 10-year class reunion, which, uh-huh, of course, the person realized was sort of probably not the best way to go about this. But
It's counterproductive. I mean, did any of them rethink their tactics at the time? Like, we went overboard?
People who
we were part of a rush to judgment.
The players.
He stood against that rush. He was proven right. Therefore, we bear some responsibility for being wrong.
I tried to talk to a number of professors who had been outspoken. Some declined to speak because I think for many of them it is kind of an embarrassing moment. A little bit. My general sense is that there weren't many apologies.
Did you watch any tapes when Miller was essentially the warm-up act for Trump on the campaign trail?
I did not really. I've read a little about it, but I haven't watched too much of it.
Yeah. What we saw on the Sunday shows was the he will not be questioned and working himself up into a lather and this kind of, I mean, you hate the Hitler comparison, but maybe just because he's like the skinny guy with his squeaky voice, of all the crazed ranters, he at times reminded me the most of the Fuhrer vein of things.
Well, I'll leave that one for you. But I think one thing that was clear was he clearly, and several people told me this, like he liked the fight.
Sure.
There were other people who appeared on shows with him, on Nancy Grace with him that I talked to, and it was like he liked it. He liked being the conservative voice on campus, the controversial voice. That was not something where he was kind of felt like he was sacrificing by doing this. He liked being the sort of firebrand.
You know, and the other thing, I don't know if anyone brought this up to you or thought about it, but the historic parallel it reminds me of is Roy Cohn and Alger Hiss. Because Alger Hiss was a communist spy. I mean, all evidence seems to be. And Roy Cohn went strong. And then everything that Roy Cohn did afterwards was, you know, because he had this one experience where he was right and definitely felt vindicated about it. He acted that way all throughout his life and, you know, was an excessive demagogue.
Yeah, I think, I do think, I mean, who knows what would happen to his career path, but there is, you know, something to being vindicated early on that's just going to, you know, make you think that the next time you do it, it's going to be okay. And the next time you do it, it's going to be all right again. So I'm sure it builds up, you know, some muscles there.
And also Roy Cohn was a key advisor to Donald Trump. And now Stephen Miller is a key advisor to Donald Trump.
Yeah, it all comes together.
It does. It is one president we have. Reeves Weidman, contributing editor for New York Magazine. He wrote about Stephen Miller and Richard Spencer and their time at Duke. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
And now the spiel. So I love that Face the Nation thing where they talk to the average voter, they get a panel together. And I especially loved when Dickerson went all rapid fire.
Susie, a word or a phrase that describes the country right now?
Scary.
Tenuous.
Jerry?
In deep trouble.
Conflicted.
Armor?
Moving forward.
Darth?
Disturbing.
Montgomery?
Excellent.
Dale?
Divided.
Anthony?
Unsure.
Jimmy?
Dynamite!
Dora?
Bananas, nuts, chocolate tree!
Fred?
Divided.
Eliza?
Uncertain.
Keith?
Divisive.
Menomina guy?
Menomina.
The word that I would have said is, in fact, menomina. That guy totally nailed it. That is apt. But also, if menomina were taken, I'd have said confused. Not exactly divided. We are divided, but that doesn't get at the heart of our trouble. Not anxious. We're anxious, but that begs the inquiry, is the anxiety deserved or not? During the Obama administration, we could say anxious because there were plenty of people who wanted their country back and it was making them anxious. But confused. Yes, confused. And it is a confusing time. Some of the confusion is just that voters are literally confused. They don't know what the facts are. They react to misinformation. They're definitely overwhelmed, especially by technology-enabled misfacts. But even among voters who know what the real unemployment rate is, and even among voters who know that China didn't just stop manipulating currency when Trump came into office, and even among voters who don't think the inauguration set a record, even among those voters, their confusion is because we can't quite understand how anyone can think otherwise. Like, I am confused who is buying into the inauguration set a record line. We've been given explanations for this mass confusion. Some seek to explain the mechanisms by which we're confused, the internet and fake news, original meaning, which overwhelm our senses. As creatures who survive because we react to threats, it is actually adaptive to see a dire prediction and say, oh yeah, that might be true. Some other explanations as to why we're confused are psychological. In these hard times, we seek out bold answers. We search for those who resonate with us emotionally, and once we find that connection, we hope that truth will flow. And some of the explanation of our confusion is just a practical explanation. You know, the world really is harder to understand. I think all those reasons are right. And I don't think things are going to get less confusing anytime soon. I do know this. As much as the stakes seem high to us meaning the plugged in, the observant, the passionate about where society is going, to many of our fellow citizens of the country and the world, we're just overwhelmed. Look at the turnout in the special election in Georgia's 6th. I have never seen attention paid to a special election for a Congress seat like this, ever. You haven't either. It was all everyone in my Twitter feed was tweeting about, except if you were tweeting about the NBA playoffs. But even then, look at the turnout, though. 192,000 people voted in total in the special election. But in 2016, which was a presidential year, 326,000 people voted for Congress in that district. Now, 192,000 for a special election, that's high for a special election, but I just read the numbers. I mean, you could tell that it was over a third off what the vote was in 2016. And this was all anyone who I knew was paying attention to. There were millions of dollars spent on this race. Whatever the unit of psychic energy is, there was billions of that. And fewer than half the eligible voters actually participated in it. Look at the French election. About 35 million voters went to the polls. The turnout was 75%. Now, in a U.S. presidential election, that would be the highest since 1896. But in France, it was the lowest since 1969. How is that? How could that be? Granted, I'm a little enthusiastic about elections. I was at the Mets game on Sunday when the French election was going on, and I was desperately checking my phone, trying to get results. And for more context, one of the reasons I was desperately trying to get results from my phone is that the Mets weren't doing well. They got one hit, and the most exciting thing that happened for the Mets was that Le Pen was defeated. I'm not quite sure how that worked, but it definitely would help the Mets. But of all the confusing things about these times, I find that this relatively low voter turnout the most confusing. So on the one hand, we're told that there's this wave of populism, and political scientists and learned observers are expending their talents to suss out what's going on and how come everything's changed. And also, has it waxed? Has it waned? Has it crested? Has it crashed? I mean, we are talking about the very path of our society. But what society is actually telling us is that these tumultuous, angry, confusing, conflicting times aren't any of those things, actually. They're not tumultuous or angry. They're mostly indifferent. There's good evidence that indifference is ruling the day. And in France, by the way, now let's say you're saying to yourself, yes, but the French still had 75% turnout. Well, listen to this statistic. In France, you can go to the ballot and say, I don't want to vote for anyone, or you could just kind of deface the ballot. It's called spoiling the ballot. And 8% of the ballots were left blank, and 3% was spoiled. So once again, wins the day. Who knows? Or maybe just, it's just far too confusing. I have sympathy for anyone who's trying to figure this moment out, like I am, like you are. And I'm not saying it's easy, or that one side, the populist nationalist side, or the globalist, realistic, statistic, empirical side, I'm not saying that one of those sides has all the answers, but I have never lived in a moment when the wrong choice has been more wrong. And whatever else we decide about this wave cresting, crashing, or obtaining, whatever else we decide, I hope we're coming around to the realization that one choice is far worse than the other. That's it for today's show. Just producer Mary Wilson. What word do you associate with Wile E. Coyote's craziest schemes?
Dynamite!
Just producer Chris Berube, what condition are your hockey cards housed in Mylar sheaths?
Excellent.
Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, how would you describe the president's business interests?
Conflicted.
Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Networks, what exactly does your title mean?
Unsure.
The gist, advancing, progressing. Give me a synonym.
Armor.
Moving forward.
Barbara, you are correct. Umperu, depuru, dupuru, and thanks for listening.